Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. In only four scant seasons, Stuart Winchester has metamorphosed from avid citizen skier to one of the most well-informed, and therefore well-respected, sources of information about ski areas of every stripe, particularly in America. Among the many things I like and admire about Winchester's work on the Storm Skiing Journal include, he is focused. He doesn't try to be all things to all people. He is instead laser-focused on the skier who takes a lift uphill and everywhere that's possible. He is ecumenical. If you have a rope toe, you're included. Mega resorts are not only covered, they're covered better than they are anywhere else, but it's his inclusion of the vast stratum of blue-collar feeder resorts that makes his Storm Skiing Journal so special. He doesn't tolerate fools gladly. Here is his take on current ski media, as spot on as his appraisals of the ski resort pantheon. I love this statement so much, I'm going to read it in its entirety. The state of ski media is pathetic. A once proud niche run by professional journalists with ethics and fidelity to the art of language has been displaced by a mob of brain-dead bros who care more about being cool than tending to the masses of skiers who don't spend their days skiing out of helicopters in Alaska. Even worse, the majority of this drivel is pay-to-play branded content disguised as journalism. Say nice things about our skis, kit, mountain, and we'll give you free stuff. It's unreadable, unwatchable, and worst of all, boring. And that's the best of it. Step into the sewer and swim to the bottom, and there you'll find the current bathroom waste that passes as ski gear reviews. Most of it is uninformed and unhelpful at best, deceitful at worst. Guiding skiers to skis that in no way match their ability or interests, reviews that betray the fact that the reviewer likely has never been in the same zip code as said skis, prompts to order ski boots on Amazon, which may be the single best way to ensure that a skier stays mediocre forever. I could go on about all that I like about Stu Winchester, but it's time to let him speak for himself. I'll exit my intro with this, dear listeners, the Storm Ski Journal byline. Everyone searching for skiing's soul. I'm trying to find its brains. Stuart Winchester, a very warm welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jackson. I am super fired up to be here. And I have to tell you, I've put out 160 or so podcasts, and none of them has had an intro as good as that one. So I need to work on my intro game. You've inspired me. That was great. Thank you.
My pleasure. Let's begin as I usually do with my subjects. Let's begin with your life as a skier and where that began. Where did you grow up skiing?
So I grew up in Michigan, did not grow up in a ski family. I had that one buddy who kind of liked to do everything. His name was Travis, good buddy of mine to this day. We've known each other since we were 5 years old. And one day he said, hey, there's a bus going from school after school to the local ski hill. It was called Mott Mountain. It was 200 vertical feet. It was in Farwell, Michigan. And went up there with him. I was 14, 15 years old. And it was a catastrophe. I was terrible. I think I fell 5 or 6 times on my way to the rope toe, another 8 times on my way up. I left the place black and blue, didn't get back into skiing for a couple more years. And when the same buddy, Travis, paged me again to ski, we went to another little bump called Snow Snake. And I think I'd just kind of grown into my body. I was 16 years old at this point. And only fell a couple times the whole night. So I decided, okay, this is it. I am going to ask for skis, boots, and poles for Christmas. Got those senior year of high school. And the cool part about being a skier in Michigan is the hills aren't big, but there's a lot of them. Michigan has the second most ski areas behind New York with 43 of them. And some of them are quite good, quite built up. Boyne owns 2 of them, and they have a lot of peers there. And so I would just go to a different one every week. And I just loved that adventure piece of it and the novelty and the variety and being able to go to different places. And people from the Midwest, we drive like crazy. So by the next Christmas, I was driving out to Colorado, hit Copper Mountain and Keystone, and I just never stopped.
So how did your interest in the sport, which had a roaring start, it seems like, how did that evolve into Storm Skiing Journal?
Everything I just described took place in the mid-1990s, which I think of as a golden era for ski journalism. And maybe that's somewhat whitewashed by the fact that that's when I was introduced to it. But Skiing Magazine and Snow Country and Powder and Ski, they were thick magazines. They were just as good as any circulation magazine you would see today. The writing quality was really great. The photography quality was really good and consistent. The storytelling was outstanding. And I really fell in love with that as a feature of my ski life. And what I noticed as time went on is a couple things happened. Is first of all, those publications, in whatever form they managed to continue to exist, really started to tiptoe away from covering ski areas, which is always where my passion was, and started to chase the dragon and really look for the fringe of the sport, right? The heli skiing, the mountain range, the hiking trip in Pakistan, the wild mountain range in Asia somewhere. And that's fine. It's fun. And that is part of skiing, but it's also not very relatable. And the second thing that happened was that ski media did not weather the transition to digital well. So when those magazines, who were already covering the fringes of the sport, got pushed out, that vacuum got filled by a lot of very low quality content on social media. In some ways, it's good when the gatekeepers go away and anyone has a chance, because the storm wouldn't exist without that reality. But on the other hand, everyone now has a microphone. And when you would go on Facebook and look at people talking about Killington or Vail or Palisades Tahoe or any of these big resorts, it was just a lot of opinions and usually not super well-informed ones. And I was looking for a ski podcast because I live in New York City, and anytime I have to ski, I have to drive. And I was looking for ski podcasts, and they were all kind of, and there's some very good ones, and this is not denigrating them. I'm just saying that they were all focused on talking to ski heroes and the guys who jump off cliffs and the guys who can do backflips. And it's like, okay, fine. This is not super useful information, frankly, to a guy like me who only skis off a chairlift at a ski resort. And by the way, that's what 99% of skiers do. They ski off a chairlift at a ski resort. And no one was really speaking to them anymore, not in a professional way, not in a way that was based in journalism, not in a way that was well edited. And I thought, okay, what if I create a platform that is based on those journalistic precepts and ethics, and I just feature one ski area each episode, the leader of one ski area. So that's what I did. I launched it in October 2019. So the podcast is one part of the newsletter. The rest of the newsletter is, okay, let's look at what's happening in the ski world, because there were a lot of press release reprints, like the Icon Pass adds Revelstoke. It's like, okay, cool. What does that mean, right? What does it mean for Icon Pass holders? What does it mean for skiers in the US and in Canada? What does it mean for Vail? Because every time Icon makes a move, Vail has to make a counter move. And I felt like that critical analysis piece was missing. I spent a good part of my career in sports, working at the NBA headquarters in New York City, and working in entertainment at Viacom, now Paramount. And there are large contingents of journalists that break down every little thing that each of those businesses does. So, deep look at the streaming services. You know, I worked at the NBA when LeBron James announced he was taking his talents to South Beach, and you wouldn't believe the amount of analysis that went out over that. And I felt like skiing was missing that. And I felt like skiing deserved that. And I felt that if no one else was doing it, I might as well give it a try.
Now, as of today, you've interviewed just about every ski area general manager and potentate in America, including those who rule over huge empires. But I want to begin by looking at the less well-promoted stratum of ski areas that serve the skiers priced out of the mega resort destinations. Where are the indies or the small collectives, the family-run operations that once flourished in this country? You said in one of your pieces that skiing needs a farm system. And my answer to that is, boy, does it ever. But what your research shows is we got one. It's just underpromoted. We just don't know where it is or necessarily how to go find it. There hasn't been a good umbrella organization. There is one, National Ski Areas Association, but it hasn't done a great job of pointing people in the right direction, at least as near as I can tell. Mm-hmm. By the way, just as an aside, my podcast that went out today was with C.B. Vaughan, the legendary speed ski record holder and then clothing magnate. And he began the same little pisspot resort that I did, not even Bromley, but Snow Valley, which was somewhere on a side road between Manchester and Peru, Vermont. surface lifts, but under $5 lift tickets. The indoors wasn't lavish, but you could get a burger. But point is that we've had this low entry-level stratum in this country, very widespread at one point in time, but then we killed off between 400 and 600 of them. Mm-hmm. And the survivors are the ones that you've been researching. Guide us here, Stu. Who's the most noteworthy in this stratum? Who really stands out in your mind as emblematic of either the solution or the problem? Where are the communities that are being served? The floor is yours.
Yeah, I want to point out, first of all, Jackson, that if you would like to help bring back Snow Valley, it is for sale. It is actually still a very popular backcountry spot, and it still has a standing lift, so you could make that happen.
You hear that, dear listeners? It won't be my capital resources, so one of us gonna have to come from you.
So let me zoom out here. There are, according to my count, 507 active ski areas in the United States as of the 2023 to 24 ski season. And I'm counting a few in there that did not operate in previous years that are planning comebacks, like Frostfire, North Dakota. So out of those 507, Vail owns 36 of them. Alterra owns 16, Boyne owns 9, and Powder owns 9, which means that the rest are independent. So that adds up to fewer than 17%. So that means 83% of the ski areas in the United States are still independent or owned by families or owned by municipalities. Now, there's a big range in there, right? So Jackson Hole is independent, right? So is Sun Valley and Snow Basin, which are owned by the Sinclair family. But there are still a lot of ski areas. And in fact, here's a number that might surprise folks who are worried about consolidation. Of the 50 largest ski areas by skiable acreage in America, 27 of them are still independent. So the system is still out there. It still exists. Yes, if you're in the Wasatch or you're on I-70 in Colorado or you're around Tahoe, the big ski companies focus their resources on those places for a reason. But there are ski areas in all those markets that are independent still. And there are ski areas and concentrations of ski areas throughout the country with large numbers of independents. To give you an example of a place that you would be very, very fortunate to be a skier is Boise, Idaho, because just a few miles north of town, I think it's maybe a 20 to 40 minute drive, depending on the weather, is Bogus Basin. And Bogus Basin sells a season pass for around $450, and it sells a day lift ticket for a maximum of $74. And Bogus Basin is bigger than Sun Valley. It is 1,800 vertical feet, 2,600 acres. They have 4 high-speed quads. So if you're in Boise, Idaho, you know, this is not a rope toe bump you have to settle for. This is a darn good ski area that is run as a nonprofit. And Mount Spokane up in Washington run very similarly, and also extremely affordable lift tickets there, $59 on weekdays, $75 on weekends. The season pass is right around $500 at early bird prices in Mount Spokane. Same thing, 2,000 foot vertical drop, 1,700 acres. Now, you do have 5 riblet chairs and a new sky track. So you don't have, you know, you're riding a fixed grip chair for 1,700 vertical feet. But, you know, if you ski hard, I think the rest is well earned and well appreciated on the lift. So there are still, Jackson, some communities out there that are not only served by ski areas, but are served by large ski areas that are, from a statistical point of view, not that far off from some of the destination mega resorts that you might visit on your Epic or Icon Pass.
Are there other programs like Sky Tavern, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Erin Reno, which is community supported and parents pitch in and you're only operating on weekends, but between a couple of school buses, you get some kids up skiing who otherwise would have absolutely no access to the sport. Other institutions like that that you know of?
I'll say, first of all, Sky Tavern is really special. It's hard to have a mountain all to your own. And it takes an incredible community and some incredible individuals and a board to be able to organize something like that. And Sky Tavern is the preeminent version of that in the United States. There are some others that do similar things. So in New Jersey, there's an organization called Winter for Kids, run by a gentleman named Sean Mallier. And he purchased the old Hidden Valley ski area, which is right next to Mountain Creek, which is a big ski area. It used to be owned by IntraWest, but now is owned by Snow Partners, which also is operating the Big Snow indoor skiing facilities.
Wasn't Mountain Creek where the Playboy Club was also?
Yeah, it was.
Look where my mind goes, by the way. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, Mountain Creek's great, but right next door is National Winter Activity Center and run by Winter for Kids. What Sean did is he bought Hidden Valley, he gutted it, he put in two brand new chairlifts, I believe a quad and a triple fixed grip lifts. And he takes kids from local schools and he puts them in programs that gives them 6 days per year, 2 days snowboarding, 2 days downhill skiing, 2 days cross country skiing. And so they get the repetition of different laps. He includes all the gear. He has this system, and I don't understand how he does this, but from the time they pull into the bus, the time on the lift is 15 minutes, which me as an experienced person who knows what I'm doing, I can't even get on the lift that fast when I pull into the parking lot. So that is one that I think is probably the best aside from Sky Tavern. The rest are less based on mountains than programs, right? Where as opposed to having like Sky Tavern or National Winter Activity Center, where you have a whole ski area dedicated to this program. Vail Resorts actually has a huge program, and they think it's something like 5,000 kids every year at their small ski areas in the Midwest that they take up and show how to ski. And then there's little rope toes all over the place, especially in New England, in the Midwest, and Colorado actually has quite a few as well, where they're just school buses full of kids in the parking lot. And they that's their whole business, is they kind of the same way that I learned how to ski, which was the bus was free, the gear was $5, and the lift ticket was $6, and I was skiing, right? Not very well, but I was out there, and it put the idea in my head. And sometimes it's all you need is someone to tell you you are a skier and sort of give you that permission to do it. And there's a lot of places in the country that are still doing that, that just get overlooked by the, certainly by the ski media, because they're frankly not super exciting to ski at, but they do plant that bug. And for someone who's never skied, 200 vertical feet is quite a lot of fun and quite a challenge, and it'll plant that seed with them.
What we're kind of looking for is something that inspires you a little bit more than 130 foot vertical. I think your example of Bogus Basin, which I believe was the very first resort to have one of these incredible passes. It was a season pass for $200. Yep. It had never been done.
It was the first. It was the first. Yep.
And I think that certainly should be memorialized somewhere. As Piers should all say, you know, all golfers owe, you know, Arnold Palmer a dollar, and they owe Tiger Woods a dollar. Well, all skiers owe all these guys a dollar for what they did in pioneering it. Is there any way to parts of the country we can relive kind of your youth, where you go area to area? Are there networks? If I'm in one of these corridors where I'm north enough in the country that I have ski resorts, and I have these dotted places around the map that say we've got a ski lift, are there ones that are organized so that you could take your one pass and go five different places? Or is this well known on the ground? Am I the only one who's clueless here? Everyone in the Midwest already know this.
So there's certainly places, there's certainly a lot of concentrations of ski areas in the United States that are quite affordable. The passes sort of intentionally spread them out, particularly the Indy Pass, because if they have too many too close together, it will drive the redemption rate that they give the ski areas down. And that will not make this, that will upset the ski areas, right? Because they're already worried about concentrations poaching their season passes. But there's a lot of different ways to answer this. If you look at a state like New York, there has the most ski areas of any place in the country. It has over 50 ski areas. And there's one about every, you're always within 2 hours of a ski area. And they're almost all family owned. Now, there's only seven of those ski areas that have high speed lifts, or eight of them rather. But the rest of them are in that range of 500 to 1,000 vertical feet. They have a couple lifts. They have some glades. There's a couple of nice snow belts in New York State where you can, like, there's a place called Macaulay, and a lift ticket is around $20, and it's 600 vertical feet. But they get 225 inches of snow per year, and it's nice light snow off of Lake Ontario. Snow Ridge right down the road, same thing. They get that same snow belt. It's one of the snowiest ski areas in the country. So you can get a good 500 vertical feet, a very nice repetitive powder run in at either Snow Ridge or Macaulay without having to compete for those tracks and without having to spend a lot of money. I think that the best tool for a skier who wants to explore a lot of different ski areas for not a lot of money is the Indy Pass. The Indy Pass is in a little bit of a state of flux. They're not selling them right now. They decided to end sales for the 23-24 ski season a little bit, well, really early. They ended them in April because they don't want to oversaturate their resorts. That was a bit of a controversial decision. They will bring a limited number back for sale this fall. But if you buy an Indy Pass, if you live in New England, there are 14 ski areas that you can hit on the Indy Pass in New England. And there are another six in New York State. There are another four or five in Pennsylvania, and you get 2 days at each of those. And the Indy Pass debuted at $329 for the 2023-24 ski season. It does not take a lot of days to ski that down. And these are, by the way, really, really good ski areas. So they have places like Jay Peak, which might be the best ski area in New England. Waterville Valley, which is as good as anything on the Epic. Saddleback, which is a phenomenal mountain that's just recently come back. So, you know, the Indy Pass in New England or the upper Midwest, where they have a couple dozen partners and including some of the best ski areas in the Midwest region, is a can't miss. I mean, you could have an awesome winter buying one of these things and traveling around. Out West is a little more complicated, but they do have a good partner network out there. Obviously, you're competing with Epic and Icon then. You could have a really, really good time with the Indy Pass.
What about a strange little initiative that I heard quite a bit about when it was, at least the idea was floated, not much since. It was, I think it was called Skier X. It was Bodie's affiliated idea about indoor skiing near metropolitan areas. Do you know where, did that embryo ever give birth? What's the status of that?
Yeah, so there's two. There's Big Snow, which is the only open one in the United States right now. And then there's Alpine X, who intend to build their first in suburban Virginia over the next couple of years. These indoor facilities have the potential to, I don't want to say revolutionize skiing, but become the greatest growth engine that U.S. skiing has ever seen. And here's why. There's a stat that gets thrown out a lot, that France has more skier visits than the United States, even though it has, you know, one-fifth of the population. And that's true. However, a huge part of the United States does not sit anywhere near the winter, right? Places like Florida and Texas and Georgia. And if you put a snow dome in Miami and Houston and Dallas and Jacksonville and Atlanta, what you're doing is instantly exploding skiing's addressable market, because you are bringing tens of millions of potential customers into the sport. If you grow up in Miami right now, you're not skiing unless you come from a ski family. What happened to me in Michigan is not happening to you. Your buddy's not asking you to spontaneously go after school, right? Maybe you get lucky, you go to college somewhere that's cold and you learn about it. But if you are a little kid growing up in Miami and there's a snow dome there, you're going to go there on a field trip and you might fall in love with it. And it doesn't take a lot of people for that to happen to significantly grow the number of participants that we have in skiing long term. Big Snow, Snow Partners, run by Joe Heshen, who's been on the podcast, has perfected the model at their New Jersey facility, which, by the way, they didn't build. That was built by someone else about 20 years ago and basically all but abandoned for 15 to 16 years until Snow Partners figured out a way to make it. And they've made it a great business. That place prints money and it's affordable. So it's, I don't know what the exact number is, but it's $80. And you get the lift ticket, you get all the clothes, you get the gear, you get the instruction. And that's something that would cost you $300 anywhere else. And it's right in the heart of the New York metro area, which is home to 20 million people. So even though it's in a place that does get winter, it's still been successful. So imagine what it could do if you start dropping these things other places. The issue is they are very, very, very expensive to build. And Alpine X was trying to build their first one on a hill to help mitigate some of that. It's all about, can they get the capital to actually build these things? I have no doubt that they'll be successful if they do it. And my money, and I've had the leaders of both Alpine X and Snow Partners on the podcast, I appreciate both of them, and I think they both have a good vision, but Snow Partners has actually shown the ability to get things done, and my money is on them to really be able to make this thing take off. And they want a couple dozen in the United States, and I think they can do it.
Interesting. Let's wish them well. We've had initiatives to try to build the skier population in the past, and they've all fallen flat. Tim Cole, who I interviewed recently at a podcast here on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan, said that at Alta, they've been trying for over a decade to get people who would otherwise not become skiers to come. And they, aside from a few Eastern Europeans, bupkis, crickets. Yeah. So we'll see. My experience has been, if you take people out to where it's cold and wintry and nasty, and that's kind of what they expected it to be, and then it delivers on that, they don't want to go back again. We'll see. I think, to me, skiing is a spiritual exercise, not just a physical exercise. And I wish there was some way people could start to realize that, unlike other sports, which aren't necessarily a portal to understanding yourself better, mm-hmm. I think skiing lends itself to that perhaps better than any other sport that I'm familiar with.
As you beautifully said in your book. I mean, that's, yeah, I 100% agree.
Well, thank you. So let's talk about the big boys now. You recently, I think it was, interviewed Jared Smith, who is CEO for Alterra, which has the biggest expansion plan in a single location, or maybe even including multiple locations of anybody. 3,700 acres, slick 16 lift in 3 years, and they won't be relying on natural snow. And they're still not going to allow snowboarding.
Right.
They're going to pull that off.
The key to that project is that Extel, which is a New York City-based real estate development company, is retaining ownership of the land and all of the base facilities. Alterra is essentially an operator, right? So they don't have to front that full. I mean, I don't even want to think about what that thing's going to cost, right? So they have that partner, and Extel was smart enough to say, we don't know how to run a ski area. So they're bringing Alterra in, much as the city of Denver has brought Alterra in to run Winter Park, which the city of Denver continues to own.
Is this the future of resort development, or is this simply a wild, one-of-a-kind, don't expect this to happen sort of event?
I wish I could say that there was a future of resort development, but if you want to see the future of resort development, look to British Columbia, which, as the Sun Peaks GM, Darcy Alexander, who joined me on the podcast recently, pointed out, has one of the most, his words, progressive ski area development philosophies in the world. It is almost impossible to build a new ski area in the United States today. I am shocked that this expansion is happening at all. Utah does seem to be one of the places where you can still build a new ski area. But in most of the United States, like Washington, where the population and the wealth of the population is growing, they're in a really bad situation. Because if you look in any direction from Seattle, you have three big ski areas, Summit at Snoqualmie, Stevens Pass, Crystal, all of which are absolutely overrun at all times. And there's nothing that region can do to expand capacity, other than maybe an expansion at one of the ski resorts I just mentioned, because they are just locked into a state where development in the mountains of a giant ski resort is just not going to happen. So look, I welcome any way the new ski area can be built, particularly in a region like the Wasatch, which is bursting at the seams. Utah had over 7 million skier visits last year. That was an increase over the previous record of 5 million just the previous season. And yes, Utah had a record snow year, but Salt Lake City is growing very, very quickly. And more people want to get up into the mountains. Those places are not a secret anymore. They never will be again. So the fact that we're about to add 3,700 more acres of capacity, I think it's great. I mean, is that ideal for these big companies to own so many things? I don't know, but it's not going to happen otherwise because no one else has the capital to do it. So I welcome this development.
I certainly welcome any development in which you don't have to have $1 billion as the price of admission. Mm-hmm. Don't we have one other product going in? Was it Wasatch Peach Ranch? Is that,
yes.
Is that the name right?
That's right.
That, I'm not sure what the entry price is, but it's more than slipping a 20 to the meter D.
Yes, sir.
what's going on with that development?
So Wasatch Peaks Ranch, think of it as Yellowstone Club, which most of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with, which is basically attached to Big Sky, or right next door to Big Sky, and you can ski between if you have the right passes. You know, unfortunately, if you look at Jason Blevins, he's done some really good stories on how it's easier to build an 8,000 square foot mansion for one person in Crested Butte than it is to build an employee housing project that would be a fraction of the size for 100 people. And I think we're kind of at the same place for ski areas, where Wasatch Peaks Ranch was built on private land. And by keeping it private, they were likely able to circumvent a lot of the review and other environmental impacts that would have had to go into opening a ski area for the public. So this is a consequence, I think, of our current regulatory environment and the fact that it's just very hard sometimes to build things to benefit a lot of people than things that benefit just a few super rich people.
Now, for the rest of us that don't fall into the super rich category, we're still heading into some form of a gilded age because there are more lifts, uphill transportation units on order than any time in skiing's history. And I don't think they're all going to the Midwest. I think they're going to be spread around. One question about this, I'm sure you've looked at this because you seem to be a smart lad. What type of terrain is being served by this lift expansion? We talk about the Mayflower expansion at Deer Valley. As I look at the site map, doesn't look like a lot of double black diamond terrain going on in that zone. Are we looking at mostly blue runs that are, which admittedly, that's the general public. I'm not looking my nose down on them. I take them too. When we're going to put all these lifts up in an area that's already crowded called the groomed lift serve intermediate runs, are we solving a problem or exacerbating one?
Yeah, good questions. I mean, so first of all, the new lifts are not all going on intermediate terrain. Some of them are. The Bergman Bowl expansion going in at Keystone this winter is primarily intermediate. The West Mountain expansion going in at Sugarloaf, Maine is primarily intermediate. But there is some really cool stuff happening in Colorado where Silverton is planning to put in a new lift. So they already have one lift. They're going to put in another. Aspen is opening an expansion this year that was called Pandora's. They just changed the name to Heroes. This is about a 1,200 vertical foot lift at the top of Aspen Mountain. So really well protected from climate fallout. And this is all advanced terrain, lots of good glades. Anyone who skied Aspen knows it's no joke. Good steep terrain at Aspen Mountain. And then Mahogany Ridge at Steamboat is a several hundred acre expansion that's going in skiers right of Pony Express. And this is going to be some serious terrain. This is going to completely change how you think about Steamboat Resort as an intermediate place with some nice trees. This is nasty terrain. It is a high-speed quad lapping it. And I was talking to the folks at Steamboat yesterday, and they said, we need to find a way to let the general public know that this is not for beginners. Snow Basin is building a new Des Moines Express six-pack. Not new terrain, but it's parallel to the Strawberry Gondola, which anyone who skied that knows that there's some pretty fierce terrain over there. And then Sun Valley's replacing their Challenger high-speed quad with a new sixer this year. So that should be really nice. So you do have a lot of good advanced terrain still coming online. Now, to the question of crowding, there is extensive and well-documented literature that when you expand a highway from, say, two lanes to three lanes or three lanes to four lanes, it helps for a little bit as people get used to it. But then it just draws more cars and you end up just as crowded as you did before. And this has happened over and over and over again. Now, no one's ever done that study for ski areas. Ski resorts are so secretive with their numbers that it's almost impossible to track this. My hunch is that it simply draws more skiers, unless you do something like what Big Sky is doing, which is you put in so much capacity at the base that it just funnels people out. Right now, they have an 8-pack at the base. They have a 6-pack at the base. They're putting in, I believe, a 10-passenger gondola, maybe an 8-person gondola at the base. So that's 20,000 skiers an hour that they're going to be able, or 10,000 an hour that they're going to be able to move out of the base. If you have $150 million to do that, yeah, that does help. But you need to almost overkill it.
Well, and there's no economy for the user there either. Everyone lives a long way away from there, except for a few people in Minnesota.
That's right.
And they don't bother to make it cheaper when you get there.
It makes it more expensive.
Yeah. On the other hand, again, looking up in that same glorious belt we have in the northern part of the United States, of where some of the greatest skiing in the world is, you have the Kemmerer family not going corporate, not trying mm-hmm. to sell out to some fat cat from Kohlberg and Company or somebody like that, but to a group of locals. Huh. Mm-hmm. Family ownership, as you, I'm sure, can well document, has been far more skier friendly over time than corporate masters have been. Mm-hmm. Aren't you encouraged by this role? And do you think this is possibly going to happen again? We're going to get a few things going back to, or stay in families or go back to family ownership?
I was very happy to see that Jackson Hole is staying independent for a few different reasons. And I do think it bodes well for skiing's future. So skiing needs large independence. It needs them as a foil to the big conglomerates. It needs them psychologically, right? Because skiing is this rowdy, independent thing that people do to really express themselves. And they don't want to feel like they're part of McDonald's while they're doing that. And I do think that we'll see more of this happen where the remaining independents remain independent. But I don't think it's for the same reason that some other folks do. I don't think it's because they don't want to be part of Vail or Alterra. I think it's because Vail and Alterra's pass has made it so that they don't need to be. The truth is that as much as Jackson locals grumble about the Icon Pass, that thing is a freaking cash fire hose pointed directly at their mountain. And that really enabled Jackson Hole, that income, that reliable income, enabled Jackson Hole to be able to stay independent. They don't have to be part of a larger group now. They're able to make those capital investments and keep that one of the best ski areas in the world, which is what the Kemmerers were able to do over a long period of time. So as you look around at Taos and Telluride and Snow Basin and Sun Valley, I think there's a very good chance, because all of those are part of a big pass, that as long as they have that partnership, and by the way, and I know no one wants to hear this, but I think you're going to start seeing some team changing. I don't know if you follow college football at all, but your listeners who do will see conference realignment recently happening, where basically the Pac-12 dissolved and all these teams from California and Oregon and Washington are now going to be part of conferences that are based in the Midwest and the Southeast. And right now, Icon has a really amazing lineup of partners, and Vail doesn't have that many on Epic Pass, but everything is for sale. And it's only a matter of time, in my opinion, until Vail starts making a run for some of those Icon partners and offering to pay them more per visit than Icon is. And you'll start to see some shuffling around, which will only make these independent resorts stronger, because they do have a great amount of say in how Epic and Icon passes are used to their mountain. Telluride is the only mountain on the Epic Pass you have to make reservations at. Jackson Hole and Aspen essentially forced the creation of the Icon Base Plus Pass, which took them off of the Icon Base Pass and solved their volume problems. So they have a tremendous amount of leverage, and eventually some of them are going to start using that leverage to go back and forth and make a whole lot of money. And the good news, I know people don't necessarily love their mountain being on those passes, but the good news is those passes allow that independence to go on probably indefinitely.
So if Alta wants to bar snowboarders forever, they now have the financial security to do so. Icon costs more than Epic, right? But mm-hmm. I've noticed you've done some copious graph work. Mm-hmm. I know this was also from your background and your other work. But you've done, I think, the easiest to look at analysis of which one should I get? Mm-hmm. Assuming that it's more unaffordable to get them both. There are ideal situations where you just say, you know, why not have the turkey and the roast beef? Exactly. But if you've certainly looked at them as separate entities, is one a better actor than another? If you were mm-hmm. dating, you're marrying one than the other? Mm-hmm. One's sort of a dating, the other one's more marriage. Seems like Epic rather owns, or at least would like to own, all of its properties. Alterra mm-hmm. has been content to, or Icon has been content to, make arrangements with multiple partners with whom they are not domestic partners. Where do you see this? Oh, you just told us, I guess, to some degree, you see this going. You see the push and pull of money pulling people out of one alliance and into another. But the alliances themselves aren't going anywhere, are they?
No, these are here to stay. If you're hoping that the Epic or Icon Pass will fade and you're pointing to ASC and Intra West and saying conglomerates don't work out, I've got bad news for you. That business model basically assured the future of skiing and is not going anywhere. Consumers love it, and the companies love it, and their investors love it. The Icon Pass, it's funny because they started off as equals when the Icon Pass debuted for the 2018-19 ski season. And they had about the same number of resorts and they cost about the same. But then a couple of different things happened. One was that partners started to leave the Epic Pass and go to the Icon Pass. Arapahoe Basin has done that. Snow Basin has done that. Sun Valley has done that. And Icon started to scoop up the rest of the large independents around the country, around, especially around North America. The end result of that is that Icon now has the best lineup of ski areas by quality and challenge of any ski pass that likely has ever existed. They both have about the same number of ski areas. Epic has 62 and Icon is 65. My counts are a little eclectic because I count things as two resorts that they count as one because they're not, you can't actually ski between them. But if you look closely, a lot of Epic ski areas are Alpine Valley, Ohio, and Mount Brighton, Michigan. Again, very valuable, very meaningful ski areas because they get people skiing, but they're only 200 vertical feet and they're outside Cleveland. And the truth is that no one but me and people who live within 10 miles are ever going to ski them, right? The other thing that happened is that Vail for the 2021 to 22 ski season cut their prices by 20%. So the Epic Pass, and even though they've increased them since then, Icon has increased them even more. So the differential is now pretty huge. The difference between a full Epic and a full Icon Pass is somewhere around $300, depending on where they are in their sales cycle. And I think that it is worth it. I think they give you two different experiences. Vail really in the American West has about a dozen big resorts to choose from. Icon has roughly twice that many. But besides the price, that leads to something else, which is that Epic Pass, since they're so much cheaper, and because even though Vail does limit lift tickets, you are more at risk of out-of-control crowding. And I see this difference between the two passes settling into their market. The Icon is really trying to become the premium product for the higher-end consumer, and the Epic Pass is really trying to become the product for everyone. But that does have consequences. And the result is that Alterra Icon partners have a little more control or a lot more control over how much folks will be able to access their ski areas. So by leaving the Icon Base Pass, for example, which is, I imagine, most of the Icon Pass sales, they're able to really push that entry point up and be able to get really better manage the number of customers. And no one's done that better than Jackson Hole. But for a consumer, I do think that both passes are fantastic. I think they both give you a really good value. I think if you know how to work crowds and you know how to, when you have a little bit of flexibility to ski during the week, I think that you can have a really good season on an Epic Pass as well as an Icon Pass. It just depends kind of on where you want to ski. And if you've already used up all those Vail resorts, you want to try out some of the Icon ones.
Let's talk about one of the little guys that's close to my heart, right in my backyard, Mount Rose, which I love for ski testing because, dear listeners, you don't know this area most likely, but it's a small family-owned resort, and one side faces in one direction, one faces the other. So I've got sort of winter snow and spring snow at all times to test skis in, and a very efficient lift system that I can do a lap between 8 and 10 minutes, and I can park right next to the snow. At my other big resorts around here that are big members of these past conglomerates, I can't get within 10 miles of the snow. It seems like, my God, why am I parking here? Aren't the lifts over there? Oh, yeah. But Mount Rose doesn't, I can go right to the snow. I can have as many skis as I want in my pod. No one even knows how many skis are in there and swap skis out. And we get tons of work done. Whereas at Palisades, we get two runs in
the
whole day. So who's got Mount Rose in their pocket? Is it a target for the big guys to swoop it up, or a target for the little guys to swoop up, or is it just not quite fitting as a target for either?
Well, I have good news and bad news for you. The good news is, I'll tell you the bad news first. The bad news is, yes, who wouldn't want Mount Rose? Because it's coming from the East or from the Midwest, it's always funny for me to hear you describe that as a small ski area when it has 1,800 vertical feet and two high-speed six-packs and 1,200 acres of terrain and the highest base elevation in Tahoe and 350 inches of snow. You're like, that's a great ski area. So, and it's near Reno. It's the closest ski area to Reno. So anyone would want that because it draws people and it will sell passes, right? The good news is that someone who is involved in the acquisition of ski areas has made it pretty clear that the Busser family, who's owned the resort for a while, they want a lot of money for it. They want a premium price. So if you look at when Vail came in 15 years ago and started buying up Heavenly and North Star and Kirkwood, I guarantee you they talked to the Bussers, and I guarantee they didn't like the price. And that's why they ended up with North Star instead of Mount Rose. So I don't think that you're going to see anyone buy it anytime soon. Vail already has three mountains. They don't want another Tahoe mountain. I think that Alterra, they could buy it. They could. I don't know if they, but they're not going to overspend for it. So, you know, that's the good news. I think it's going to stay independent. I hosted Greg Gavreletz, who's the new GM there, who took over after the former GM retired for 30 years at the NSAA, the National Skiers Association Convention in Savannah in May. And I had him on a panel of other resort leaders. And the topic was mega pass holdouts. And talking to leaders, another one was Gwen Hoggett, the leader of longtime CEO of Mount Baker in Washington, and saying, okay, you have this mountain that's very attractive. I mean, it could name its pass, could probably be on any one, and they would love to have it. So why have you stayed off? And what Greg told me, and he's coming onto the podcast in November to talk more about this, but essentially he said that they're doing fine and they don't need to join a mega pass because the mega passes and the skyrocketing cost of day tickets has made Mount Rose an extremely attractive option where you have things like two for Tuesdays. He was talking in particular about being open into May and Palisades Tahoe was still charging $179 or something close to that for lift tickets. He said, I'm blowing it out on weekdays because my competition thinks their product is still worth $200 for May skiing. And I don't remember how much their tickets were, but they're much less affordable or they're much more affordable than that at Mount Rose. So, you know, Greg's new. He's not going to make any big moves to anger the locals. He's a smart guy. He came from Vail Resorts, so he knows what works and what doesn't, and he wants to do it right. So I think you're in really good hands. He's young and smart and really cares about preserving the atmosphere of Mount Rose as a good, solid locals alternative to all of the choices you have at Tahoe. Like he said, he has 17 ski areas he's competing with, so he has to offer a good product.
He does a terrific job. I'm very impressed by the work they do and only wish that they had enough employees to really do what they could with junior skiing. It's just hard to get people.
Yeah.
It's hard to have a program if you don't have any instructors.
Right.
Let's touch on one more controversial issue since you seem to be up on absolutely every little detail out there. There's a gondola that's been talked about a lot in Little Cottonwood Canyon, and all sorts of alternatives have popped up as people have sort of went, gondola, how much is that bugger going to cost? Well, the answer is more than Snowbird and Alta make in a decade is what it's going to cost. Where is that hot button subject going to go, do you think?
Well, I'm going to have a lot better answer for you next week after I host one of your longtime friends, Dave Fields, the general manager of Snowbird, on the podcast. But I'll take my best shot at it now. The United States is really unique in its tolerance for personal risk. The idea in a lot of the world of having folks drive individual vehicles up into Little Cottonwood Canyon would be really a really tough sell. This is an extremely treacherous high alpine environment. And that was fine when Alta Snowbird were sort of backwaters and when SLC was a hideout. But the truth is it's too busy now. They need to do something to get cars off the road. There are a lot of other ideas, buses, tolling that they could do. I think that essentially what the gondola would do is move the base area several thousand feet down, because anyone who's ever driven down from LCC knows that, you know, you could be buried in 7 feet of snow at Alta and you get down to the airport of Salt Lake and there's not an inch of snow on the ground. it's an altitude game out there. I think that they have to do something other than have folks wait for 3 hours to on a powder day or a weekend day to get up to Alta Snowbird. I realize this is a very, very tough change for a lot of people. A lot of it could be funded with federal infrastructure dollars. A lot of it, the ski resorts could help. I'm aware that a lot of folks do not want to see this in the canyon, to mar the viewshed of the canyon. If you look at modern environmental development policy, the one thing that folks want to avoid developing is a road. A paved road is the worst thing that you can put into the wilderness. So a gondola would actually be a much more environmentally friendly approach as far as just getting people up off the road, reducing that footprint. I don't know. Personally, as you can probably tell, I'm in favor of it. There's a very strong vocal local opposition to it. I think what it's going to come down to, Jackson, as you pointed out, is money. Where does the money come from? Who pays for it? If Elton Snowbird are not willing to step up and pay for a considerable amount of it, I don't see it happening. And maybe the buses will be enough, and maybe the tolling will be enough, because that's the first part of that plan, is to try to introduce some other mass transit alternatives into the canyon. The way it is now is not sustainable. And I think throughout ski country, we need to get much more creative with our transit mix. I'm sure you've skied in Europe and seen all the different ways they have to get skiers around and not have to face the sort of skier traffic that we do routinely in Tahoe on I-70 and in the Wasatch. So a lot of creative solutions. I think there's a lot of good arguments both ways. I think there's a lot of reflexive opposition to change, but these places aren't going to get any less busy. And we need to do something to mitigate the traffic problem. And maybe it's a gondola, and maybe it'll be something else. And we'll see. It's going to be a really interesting decade, because if it happens here and the concept is proven out, it will happen in other places as well.
Fantastic insight. Stuart, you are such a refreshing person to have in ski media. As you and I both noted, we've lost more good ones than we've been able to create to replace them. I think your work is terrific. You said in one of your mission statements that your aim with the storm is that it be consistent, relevant, entertaining, and valuable. Mission accomplished, Stuart. My congratulations.
Thank you, sir. And I have to say, no one is doing the gear game better than you right now, Jackson. You are my go-to source when I'm looking to kit up. And I tell everyone I can to go to that site, because there is too much bad information. It is too easy to find, and it's really hard to find a knowledgeable person with curated information. So keep up the good work, and thanks for hosting me. I really enjoyed that. It was a lot of fun.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Stuart Winchester. Please check out Storm Skiing Journal. It's more than just a podcast. It has got tons of information on it. I'm glad to say, I think we're going to have Stuart Winchester as part of our posse for a long, long time. This has been Jackson Hogan with Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.